Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Glendora, Mississippi is a quiet town of just a few hundred people in the heart of the Mississippi Delta. It's a poor town. 63% of the population lives below the federal poverty line. Glendora was also the town where Emmett Till was killed on August 28, 1955. A single purple sign marks Till's memory on the banks of the Tallahatchie River, where two boys found his gruesomely beaten 14-year-old body. And this week, that sign was defaced, pierced by bullets. But it's not the first time the memorial has been vandalized. In 2008, a year after the sign went up, it was stolen. And in 2016, the sign was also shot and riddled with more than a dozen bullets in multiple acts of vandalism. That's three times. Three times in a decade that a memorial to America's legacy of racial terror has been destroyed. Emmett Till's death was the hate crime that changed America. But how far have we really come since Emmett Till's death? This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And a year after Charlottesville, as Washington, D.C. prepares for the second Unite the Right rally this weekend, I'm turning to Heidi Beirich for what we know about the strength of hate groups and extremist organizations in this country. She's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project.
The data shows that hate crimes are definitely up. Whether you look at city-level data that's been released recently, the trend on trend is that we have more hate crimes today than we did a year ago, and that trend goes back actually a couple of years past that. Also, the FBI's data shows that same upward tick. And, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center started collecting information on hate and bias incidents right after the election in November of 2016. And just in the 10 days after the election, we collected information on a little bit more than 900 hate and bias incidents. And that's something that other civil rights groups have found as well, that same upward trend.
And just for our listeners, can you explain what exactly a hate crime is? How do you all define hate crimes?
Sure. Well, the definition is basically something that the FBI and the federal government have, drawn up, and then it's filtered into state-level legislation and laws as well. What a hate crime is any kind of crime, whether it's a property crime all the way up to murder, where the person who is the perpetrator has indicated some sort of hateful intent. For example, if they put a swastika on a synagogue, or if they're involved in an assault and they use slur words against a particular race or religion. That tells you that what you're looking at is a hate crime.
And we know that hate crimes can be targeted at many different groups, but are there specific groups that you've seen hate crimes against and an increase since the 2016 election?
Broadly, the two populations that have seen an uptick of hate crimes against them have been Muslims and immigrants. And that has been a finding that's found across the board. You know, that's indicated in the FBI's data, city data, our data, and other organizations, for example, like ProPublica, that have been collecting information. But I have to say, every single population of color and women have seen a rise in hate crimes against them, just not at the level of Muslims and immigrants.
And I want to talk a little bit about who's behind these hate crimes and what the psychology is, the end. I don't even know how to describe it. Is there a goal for these groups other than just sheer terror?
Well, terrorizing a population is certainly part of what a hate crime is. In general, hate crime perpetrators are young white males, and they're probably influenced by hateful propaganda that they're reading on the internet. I mean, Dylann Roof, who perpetrated that horrific shooting massacre in Charleston a few years ago, is a classic example of this. He was influenced by online propaganda put out by hate groups that told him that black people were rampaging and committing violent acts against white people, and he felt like he had to do something about that. That's a particularly horrific example of something, but many times hate crimes are inspired in exactly the same way, and the way they're different than other crimes is that everybody in that community becomes fearful when they're targeted. In other words, if I'm robbed, that's a tragedy for me and a horrible thing for me. But if I'm robbed because I'm Jewish or because I'm African American, that's something that strikes fear in that entire population in that area. And that makes them particularly pernicious types of crimes.
I want to go back to what you said about the examples you gave about white men in particular being influenced by what they're seeing on the internet and perhaps other rhetoric. You know, we're in 2018. All of us have taken similar history classes about the history of the United States. And so this idea that young Americans, or maybe not all young, but the folks who are being influenced, why are they so easily influenced?
Well, unfortunately, we live in an era in which there isn't just a god-awful amount of propaganda online that young people can access that goes from, you know, conspiracy theories and lies to just nasty hate propaganda. And one of the problems with algorithms, online algorithms, is they tend to feed us more of what we look at first. So what you have, this definitely happened with Dylann Roof, is you get someone online, they start looking at some kind of ugly propaganda, and they just get dished out more and more and more of that. In other words, there's almost a radicalization process that occurs once you start going down a rabbit hole of hate online. And that makes, you know, 2018 and recent years very different than the 1990s, where it was really hard actually to find this kind of information. But nowadays, in 2 seconds online, you can be introduced to all kinds of ugly material, both on mainstream platforms, places like Reddit or Facebook, and also on, you know, big hate sites like stormfront.org. And I think that's a big factor when it comes to spreading white supremacist ideas among young people.
Also, I think the word that you used, radicalized, is one that, in particular, the media has often only used to describe, and politicians have only used to describe, terrorism that comes from outside of the United States. That word, to radicalize young Americans, is often, we don't put those two things together, and in fact, that seems to be exactly what's happening.
This is a very, I think, serious situation when it comes to journalism, actually. You know, when somebody is influenced by ISIS in exactly the same way, watching YouTube videos, for example, being tweeted at, and then, some act of domestic terrorism occurs, we see this all as a pattern, right? We say, well, those people who committed that violence were influenced by a pernicious ideology, some sort of extremist form of Islam. But when it comes to young white men who are influenced by white supremacy, we treat the instances of violence as though they're one-offs, like they're not connected. But the truth is that white supremacist ideology is just as pernicious in terms of producing violence as something coming from Al-Qaeda or ISIS. But for some reason, we are very reluctant to see that pattern. I surmise sometimes that it's because white supremacy is indigenous, right? It was born with this country. And, you know, ISIS is a foreign entity. We can see that as coming in. It has nothing to do with our society. But white supremacy is a bedrock of our history. We are producing and have produced historically the thinking that can lead to this violence. And we seem very reluctant to see that as a pattern.
We're talking about the state of hate and extremist organizations in the United States as we head into what could be a very tense weekend in Washington, D.C., with Heidi Beirich of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Heidi, let's turn to what's happening in D.C. this weekend. The Unite the Right rally, organized by Jason Kessler, is planning for their second rally. These were the same folks that did the rally last year in Charlottesville, which we will be commemorating this week. Who is Jason Kessler, and what do we know about this Unite the Right organization or group?
Sure. Jason Kessler's a somewhat interesting figure. He started his politics actually on the left with like the Occupy movement. And then he moved to the hard right, and he made his way through some conservative publications like Daily Caller. He wrote for them for a while, and then eventually came to the position of supporting white supremacy, basically. The idea that whites are under attack, they're suffering from some sort of genocide, and we need to stand up for their rights. You know, the rally this weekend in D.C. is called, you know, a rally for white civil rights, this idea that white people are under attack and are somehow being victimized in the current environment. I will say, though, that the fallout from the rallies last year, the Charlottesville rallies, have left the players that were involved there in a much more muted stance. We don't expect Kessler to have that many people showing up in D.C. because it hasn't really gone very well in the last year for those who were at the rallies last year.
Now, does that run the risk of pushing these groups further into the margins? Is it helpful to see who these people are and know who they are? I just feel like there's so many people whose jaws are dropping just to think that here we are 1 year later and we're having another rally about something that I think most Americans would agree they'd rather not see.
Sure. I mean, that's true. And there have been other rallies. There was a rally last weekend in Portland by a group called the Proud Boys, which is rabidly Islamophobic, for example. I mean, this Kessler rally this weekend is actually the third of the summer that has been about racism and white supremacy. And I know Americans may be surprised by this, but we have a hate movement in this country that has been growing for some time. And I'm not just talking about in the last couple of years. The Southern Poverty Law Center collects information on hate groups every year. And we've seen a sustained rise basically since the year 2000 in those organizations. We've also seen huge growth in web presence on hate sites. For example, the Daily Stormer, which is a big neo-Nazi site that's been connected to domestic terrorism, they have about 450,000 unique page views a month. And that's big. And that is an audience that grew from almost nothing about 4 or 5 years ago to those numbers. And you'll find the same thing across other hate sites. So this movement is burgeoning in the current environment. It's growing. And I know most Americans are horrified by that. But what we saw in Charlottesville last year, what we've seen in Portland over the last couple months, are indicators that, you know, we have a serious white supremacy problem still in this country today, even though most people think that couldn't be possible in 2018.
So let's talk a little bit about, more broadly, the rise of white supremacy thinking and or maybe not the rise, but the outing of white supremacists in the United States and the influence that these folks are starting to have in our public policy. We're seeing candidates for political office, including Corey Stewart, who won the Virginia Republican Senate primary. What do you have to say about that? I mean, obviously, these folks have enough support to be voted in.
Yes, this is perhaps the scariest thing that's been happening over the last couple of years. I mean, it's one thing when these groups are way on the fringes, but it's another thing when candidates, as you describe, are picking up their themes and running for office on them. And, you know, the big thing here, frankly, is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has played footsie with these folks. He's tweeted out horrible things like his descriptions of African countries and Haiti, anti-Muslim videos from a hate group in England. And he's put in policies that people on the radical right, regardless of how, you know, Charlottesville impacted them, are very, very happy about. The Muslim ban is a great example. They don't want Muslims in this country. They believe that Muslims are inherently evil or terroristic. The immigration policies that we're having, whether it's the child separations, the ICE raids and whatnot, these are ideas that people on the fringes of the right have been pushing for aggressively for decades. I mean, people sometimes don't understand that David Duke, the former Klan leader and a major anti-Semite who was at Charlottesville but won't be showing up in D.C., he was talking about a border wall decades ago. So we have seen ideas that were truly fringe when it comes to immigration make their way from the bizarrest section of the furthest part of the right and now actually become policy. And that is something that impacts millions.
We've also seen, so I do want to mention a statistic here that I thought was pretty stunning. 9% of Americans in a survey from ABC News and Washington Post last August said it was acceptable to hold neo-Nazi or white supremacist views. In other words, 22 million Americans, as of this poll last August, said that was okay. Is that, in your estimation, pretty much where we've always been? Or is this something that more Americans are more comfortable being open about?
Well, I found those poll results stunning as well. And I actually think it indicates that there is less of a reluctance to admit to extremist views on race. I mean, the idea that people would say it's okay to be a neo-Nazi is just shocking to me, given what happened in Nazi Germany. And I think that those poll results, and when you extrapolate them out, as you indicated, to 20-plus million Americans, show that we have a rising radicalization in racial and and anti-Semitic views in this country. And, you know, it used to be that people just, even if they harbored these views in private, they would not say things in public that we are hearing in public today. And I think it shows a great coarsening and a backsliding, frankly, on racial justice issues in the country.
Now, we are seeing lots and lots and lots of viral videos across the country, everything from Barbecue Becky's on, to the examples of, that we saw here in New York, Adam, a lawyer who was yelling at Latinos for speaking Spanish. It seems to be that the penalty, at least, is a social shaming, right? Are these folks losing their jobs for et cetera? But I mean, does that really solve anything? To me, it feels like it's a temporary fix that makes the internet feel good, but it doesn't really get at the core of the problem.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. You know, I'm glad when these things are brought to attention, obviously, for the person who's been sort of, you know, completely unfairly victimized and pointed out. But the truth is this country really needs to have a frank conversation about race and its impact. You know, we're not like Germany that actually went through a national effort to evaluate what happened during the Nazi era. You know, we had a civil war in the 1800s that basically the South lost, but discrimination against African Americans by law, right, Jim Crow and so on, just continued. And we just really haven't had that reckoning in this country about what people of color face. And these examples keep popping up, and we obviously know that there are many, many more of them than just what we've become aware of. And we need to really confront this issue. We need to confront white supremacy, reject these ideas, cleanse the political system of them, and try to get on the right path here, because it's just grossly unfair. And we are, you know, this country is going to be a majority-minority population in just, you know, a couple decades. So we can't have this kind of race hate going on a regular basis if we want to have a real strong democracy in the future.
Heidi Beirich is director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Projects. Heidi, thanks for your insights.
I really appreciate being on.
Okay, now it's your turn. We know hate crimes are on the rise nationally, but have you seen a change in your community, for good or for bad, since the Charlottesville rally of a year ago?
Hi, this is Eric from Omaha, Nebraska. Although there have been some random acts of, inappropriate behavior, to say the very least, vandalism of some mosques in the area and also swastikas left at random parks. I would say the town in general here, the city is very inclusive and has become more inclusive as a result of that.
Hi, this is Kate. I live an hour away from Charlottesville in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I was an anti-racism activist before the Unite the Right rally. Altogether, we're unified against Kessler and his ilk, but we still recognize that the racism is all over this region. And if we're honest with ourselves, it's everywhere in America.
We want to keep hearing from you. Tell us whether your community is different now than it was a year ago. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
This is not just an issue for Ferguson. This is an issue for America.
We got to fight back!
As Michael Brown moved toward Officer Wilson, several more shots were fired by the officer, and Michael Brown was fatally wounded.
Everybody want me to be calm. Do you know how them bullets hit my son? What they did to his body as they entered his body?
Let that issue back!
And that's when they threw the tear gas at us. The protesters are tired. They're tired of going through the same thing over and over again.
4 years ago today, 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. Brown's killing sparked mass outrage and protests in the streets. Several months later,
our investigation and presentation of the evidence to the grand jury in St. Louis County has been completed. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson.
A grand jury failed to indict Wilson and protests erupted again. This time, much of the furor was directed at the St. Louis County prosecutor, Robert McCullough, who many felt had not done enough to secure a grand jury indictment. This week, St. Louis voters took to the polls and ousted the 28-year incumbent in favor of Wesley Bell, a young Black city councilman and attorney who got into politics in the aftermath of Michael Brown's death. Here's Bell on our show back in 2015.
I represent protesters. I represent anyone who's been disconnected and disenfranchised, but I also represent every hardworking officer who's sick of their name being drug in the mud because of the actions of a few. Every day I wake up and say, what can I do to make this city better? And that's the way I'm going to proceed. If we get it right here in Ferguson, the world is going to take notice.
Rachel Lipman is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, where she covers city policy and criminal justice. Rachel, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Danzina. It's a pleasure.
So, big historic moment today. Tell us a little bit about Wesley Bell's campaign and what resonated with voters there.
Bell's campaign was focused a lot on the idea that the prosecutor can be a leading sort of spearhead in reforming the criminal justice system, using the power of prosecutorial discretion to send more people to diversion programs, increasing transparency, letting individuals know who he was prosecuting, what he was charging them with, eliminating cash bail. He has pledged never to use the death penalty. Themes that a lot of these national groups that actually supported his campaign, supported Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, have supported other individuals running for prosecutor's office, have really been pushing. And it was a campaign built on activists and protesters. They got out the vote. They made contact with people. Color of Change PAC dumped $100,000 into organizing. The ACLU of Missouri and their national organization dumped about another $250,000 into the race. And it was one where he was presenting people with an alternative. They saw that they had the ability to and a viable candidate to oust a long-term incumbent, and they did.
Well, let's talk a little bit. You mentioned Color of Change PAC and a couple of other organizations that have thrown money at this campaign. Does this indicate that there is actually an ability to support more candidates like Bell going forward?
So Bell is not the first candidate that they have supported. He's one of the few incumbents that they have been able to oust. I believe Larry Krasner's seat was an open one. They've had other successes in other areas where I think outside sort of local dynamics were a little bit more important than sort of an overall message of criminal justice reform. I get the sense that this may have been the first one where this idea that the prosecutor can be transformative in criminal justice really sort of took hold because, as you mentioned at the top of the show, this is a community that has seen what can happen when a prosecutor isn't, in their minds, reformative, when at the municipal level prosecutors aren't looking at reform, when the criminal justice system just isn't working for these people.
And during the Bell's campaign for city council, he did not have the support of activist groups, but this time he did. So what was the change? Was it Michael Brown or something else?
You know, that's kind of hard to tell because the reason Bell didn't have the support of a lot of the protesters and activists in that first run was his connection to the municipal court system, which a lot of people saw as being predatory. He had been a municipal prosecutor and a municipal judge in a court that actually ended up being sued by the federal government over some of its practices. I don't know if it is that they saw in his role as Ferguson City Councilman in helping negotiate a settlement to the federal civil rights lawsuit that was filed, that he really was able to put some of his words into action. And also, he was an alternative to Bob McCullough, who, while Ferguson wasn't necessarily part of the narrative of this race, it didn't come up between the two candidates. 4 years is a really long time, politically speaking. It was definitely an overtone, and a lot of people were celebrating, a lot of activists who were supported Bell and were very much opposed to McCullough were celebrating and, you know, tying it to, hey, almost 4 years to the date after Michael Brown was shot and killed, we've now ousted the prosecutor who failed to get justice for him.
Right. And I was just going to ask about whether or not, you know, this seen as an election win specifically for the Ferguson community because of the sort of attitude towards McCullough and the frustration with what happened with the Michael Brown case?
You would have to think that, yes, it is seen as, you know, kind of a I wouldn't think they would call it justice. I think obviously they would have rather never had Michael Brown shot and killed. They would have never had the protests that, you know, just rolled through their community night after night, exposed a lot of their residents to violence and tear gas and the stress and of constant police presence. But in a way, it's a small measure of victory. And this was not, you know, a tight race. This was 17 percentage points in a county that is still 80% white. That meant Bell had to find a, you know, cross-section of African-American white voters, voters of color from North County, West County, South County, very traditional African-American and from white areas. So is it justice in the sense that it is a maturation of a kind of political wave, political activism that started after Michael Brown's death? Yes, but I bet you to a T, the protesters would tell you we would rather still have Michael Brown with us at 22 years old, getting ready to, you know, finish college and make the decision for the next step in his life.
Rachel, I'm wondering, too, one of the big issues that came out after Michael Brown's death was how St. Louis in particular, and in particular Ferguson, had been really punitive with issuing tickets to particularly to black motorists. Is that something that Bell seems to be willing to address? And
it's
we've got about 30 seconds left, just FYI.
Sure. It's not something that he'll be able to necessarily have a great role in as county prosecutor, with the municipal system being separate from the state and the circuit system. But he has pledged to use his power and his voice as prosecutor to push for a reform. And he seems to be very inclined to say that that applies to municipal courts, education, healthcare, all of those things.
Rachel Lipman, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Remember Magnum P.I.? The show where Tom Selleck played a private investigator living in Hawaii? Well, its last episode aired in 1988, so don't feel so bad if you did forget about it. But like so many old movies and TV shows, Hollywood is bringing it back, and this time with a Latino actor, Jay Hernandez, in the lead role. So is this a victory for representation? Last weekend at a press conference for the Magnum P.I. reboot, TV critic Yolanda Machado asked the show's producers about their main character's cultural identity and how it would factor into the new show. Their response, quote, "We're certainly not denying the fact that he's Latino, but it's something that is acknowledged and we plan to acknowledge it through the series." When Machado pressed further, asking whether the show had any Latinx writers, the producer said no, quote, "It's incredibly hard to find writers." Hard to find writers? Yolanda Machado joins me now, along with Melora Rivera, a writer who's worked on shows including Black Lightning on the CW and Love is on OWN. Yolanda, you cover the television industry. Melora, you've worked as a writer in the industry. What do you both think? Is it hard to find Latino writers?
Only if you don't look.
I mean, there seem to be three, at least two of us on the line right now who can do this job, right?
There are certainly us out there in a multitude of ways.
Fantastic. Well, let me see. Yolanda, we'll start with you. I mean, after you spoke with the Magnum PI producers last Sunday, Peter Lenkoff, who's the executive producer that originally told you there were no Latino writers on the show, then tweeted out a correction saying that there's actually one Latino writer on the show. Does that change how you feel?
No, honestly, because the fact that the way he tweeted it out, I think he said something like he wasn't expecting it, the question or something like that. It was like, well, that's a problem too. Like, why would you not expect somebody to ask about whether there's Latinx writers in the room when you have a Latino lead? Like, especially today, like, and I covered the whole TCA, well, not the whole, like 3 or 4 days of the TCA panel. And there was another network who was very upfront and said, look, this is our percentages where we're at with the writer's room right now. We know we have work to do. So, you know, they even showed their progress and they even specified where they have work to do. And it kind of seemed like, you know, here, and they were going back and forth like, do we? No, we don't.
Well, it sounds like, it sounds a lot, Yolanda, like many industries right now, tech industry, the media industry. I mean, we're all sitting here going, how do we prove we can, you know, include more people and be more inclusive and be more diverse? And it's always a struggle. But Melora, you're a writer and you also work for a production company and you sort of have the inside look here on how the process of actually putting writing staffs together work. So what are the challenges that you've seen?
There are plenty of resources out there, but it comes down to effort. you know? And I think for a show that has a Latino lead, you should put forth a little effort to make sure that that room is diverse, is inclusive of people that really reflect that experience and who have lived that experience. It's only going to help the show feel more authentic to the viewer when they watch it on the other end. And there are plenty of resources out there. The WGA puts out a brown book that features a lot of Latino writers. There's a Clubhouse that's a collective of gay and Latino feature and TV writers. There's a Latina listserv out there that's generated by writers in the industry who feel overlooked, who aren't getting out there for those jobs as often. But it really takes the showrunner making this a concerted effort and looking for those people. There's certainly the resources and there are certainly the writers out there.
Well, and speaking of resources, a couple months ago, I spoke with Tanya Saracho, the creator of Vida on Stars, mm-hmm. that does have an all Latinx writing staff. And in response to this issue, she actually tweeted a list of, I think, more than 150 Latino writers while staffing the writer's room for Vida's first season. So I'm wondering, you know, we have a similar issue here in, like I said, in journalism, where people say, we can't find the writers, we can't find them. I guess Saracho proved that they're there and they can be found. Curious, for both of you, when you heard that Jay Hernandez had been cast as the show's lead, Yolanda, what was your reaction to that?
I'm always in a wait and see sort of thing because I also have seen Latinos and other people of color be cast and then be tokenized because there aren't any Latinx writers or people of color in the writer's room or director's chairs or crew or, you know, all of the behind the scenes. And it's because they can't write from a point of authenticity as to the experience. And so I always hold my breath whenever I see something. Like, I love Jay Hernandez. I think he's got, like, such charisma and he's amazing. So as far as fitting the role, I was like, yay. But at the same time, I was like, well, what are we even going to know why Magnum, you know, where he came from, how this is going to change his character? Because the original Magnum, you know, white guy living in the prime of, you know, white guy privilege. This is going to change who the character is, even in like some small, tiny amount. Who you are influences what you become.
Melora, I'm curious to hear from you as a writer, because a couple of years ago, I wrote a piece for the New York Times that looked at the fact that there were Latinos being cast on television, but they were being cast in pretty stereotypical roles, mm-hmm. right? So the sexy, hot pot Latina, et cetera. Do you see, like, how does one write for a Latino, quote unquote, character without falling into these stereotypes?
Well, you know, I thought the comment from the executive producer of Magnum PI was very interesting, this idea that they're not going to hide the race of this character, when in fact it should be something that's celebrated. The differences and the nuances of that character being Latino should influence the show in a way that is drastically different and that resonates with Latino audiences. And the fact that they feel like it's not something that they have to hide, it seems like already the wrong approach, rather than celebrating what makes this character uniquely different, what makes their perspective and experience uniquely different. That's really, I think, where you get the beauty of what makes us unique from each other. And having a Latino character in that space could have been a very interesting thing to explore. I mean, the history of Asian Americans in that country, in that state, rather, is very compelling, and to not explore any of that storytelling leaves a lot of rich material on the table. And unfortunately, I think that's going to reflect in the product, and hopefully the viewers, you know, react to that.
Yolanda, I'm curious about your thoughts on that, because I feel like sometimes when we do look at not only do we, are we stereotyped as Latinos, but then there's sort of like, you know, the idea of, well, we will add some tacos to the scene, or maybe we'll put some other, you know, sombreros or something. Like, well, how do we get past it, in your opinion? Those limiting views.
Yeah, it really does take representation at all levels, mm-hmm. so that it comes across authentically. Like with Tanya Saracho, what she did with Vida, when you watch it, it's very specific. You know, it's especially specific to the LA Latino experience. However, you relate to it because it touches on other things like family relationships and stuff. But then it represents, you know, specifically LA Latinx people in a certain way that we feel represented, we feel seen, and it's not tokenizing, it's not a stereotype, it is an authentic experience. So it's
quickly here,
really
though, for both of you, quickly here, we've got about 30 seconds left. Who was the person that you saw? Did you ever feel that you were represented on the screen? For me, it was Maria from Sesame Street. Both of you?
For me, it was America Ferrera's character in Real Women Have Curves.
Melora? Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was Kara in Being Mary Jane, a professional woman raising a kid on her own.
Fantastic. Yolanda Machado is a freelance film critic and TV critic for Remezcla, Marie Claire and Harper's Bazaar, and Melora Rivera is co-producer of Black Lightning on the CW and Love is on OWN. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.